Today we are starting the day with a very exciting panel on this controversial topic called software-defined storage. There's a lot of buzz in the industry around this topic, given the success or the adoption of software-defined networking. And I have been talking to a lot of people over the last 6 months, and what I find very challenging is that there are so many diverse opinions on software-defined storage, what it means. Some people think we already have it. Some people think that it's never going to be there because it's just a very loosely defined term. So we thought we'll have a panel to actually discuss the topic. And my hope here is not to come up with some crisp and agreed upon definition of software-defined storage, but to see what some of our panelists who have a lot of experience, decades of experience in storage industry, think about this term and what do they make out of it, or what's their utopia or ideal storage system for the next evolution of data centers. So with that, we'll start with brief introduction for all the panelists, and then there would be a roughly 5 to 10 minute presentation from each of the panelists where they will go over their view, and then we'll open it for discussion. And I encourage everyone to think of lots of questions during the presentation to ask once the presentations are over. With that, let's start from the other end, Bill, in terms of introduction.
All right, so I'm Bill Earle. I'm with VMware, working in operating systems and distributed systems for a long time, and my current project is a software-defined storage system.
I'm Robert Novak. I'm with Nixenta, and I'm working on an object storage system.
My name is Umesh Maheshwari. I'm a founder and CTO at a company called Nimble Storage. We make enterprise storage systems that have both flash and disk drives. My background is in building file systems and object database systems.
Okay. Hi, I'm Jay Kistler. I'm a CTO and a co-founder at Maginetics. We're a software company with a storage product. Located in Mountain View, and my background's also in file systems, and we love object stores.
I'm David Black, a distinguished engineer with EMC, a rather large storage company. Been there about 15 years, and I've done work in both storage and networking. So I'm one of the people who originally designed and led standardization of the iSCSI protocol, worked on things like parallel NFS and FCOE. Also have a great deal of networking background. You'll find my name on the standards for things like differentiated services for IP and explicit congestion notification. So you can decide whether I'm a storage guy who knows a thing or two about networking or a networking guy who knows a thing or two about storage.
Okay, thanks everyone. So let's go through the presentations now, and we can probably go in the same order. So I would actually recommend that you can actually speak from here, and you'll have the slides in front of you.
So my take on software-defined storage is that it's a way to provide a seamless pool of resources built out of commodity components. It should be uniformly accessible from everywhere in your data center and indeed eventually around the world. It should be allocated on demand. As I say, the consumer of the storage shouldn't have to know how it's built underneath. You just say, just like when you put objects in Amazon S3, you just say, put them in there, you don't ask, where are the bits stored, what's the RAID structure underneath, or any of those sort of things. So it's an abstraction of storage based on the qualities of service that you desire from it, not about how it's built. So it's a separation of consumption interfaces. I have a policy-based driven management and producer-side interfaces, the people who actually do have to worry about the physical boxes. By specifying the qualities of service, we are able to separate the concerns about which physical resources, whether they're flash devices, future solid state persistent memories, spinning disk drives, whatever those resources are underneath, from what the application needs. And if it turns out that for operational reasons the application has to move, the mix of those things may well change, but the application should get the same behavior. Not only do we wish to be able to specify those sort of things when we create the application, we also want to be able to change them on the fly for business agility. In other words, if my marketing campaign takes off and my web service needs lots more IOPS in the database to handle all the orders, I'll be able to just turn the dial up and get more performance in a shorter period of time, not by ordering new storage arrays from some vendor and having to get them installed, which might take months. So it's a way to turn a set of resources into something that's available on demand to meet immediate business needs. A key point is that the consumer's only specifying what the outputs should be, not what the inputs are. On the provider side, the provider needs to be able to manage the physical devices. That's to say, if I have a rack of older equipment, it's gone off lease, it's time to toss it, I need to be able to say, well, gracefully evacuate that and be sure that the applications will keep running, that the consumers don't need to ever see that. It just smoothly moves somewhere else, and when I get a notice that the rack is empty, I can just power it off and take it away. As I add resources, similarly the system needs to migrate existing loads onto those new resources as needed, just seamlessly integrate them, not just for capacity, but also for reliability and the ability to respond, to recover from failures quickly. If I spread the resources over all the boxes and recover on using all the boxes when some particular thing fails, the impact on any one is very small compared to some simple mirroring models. And I need usage trend analysis to say, what am I running low on? Or is the balance that I've got in my data center wrong? What should I put on my next order? Should I order more disk drives? Should I order more CPUs? What's the ratio I should, for my next order to keep up with not where I am today, but where I'm going? And lastly, the model that I've been pursuing with my current project is server-based storage, basically taking server boxes and sticking either disk drives and flash drives within the boxes or in attached JBOD trays, and turning that into shared software-defined storage that meets these requirements. Current status, there's some examples out there. These are just a couple. One is my project vSAN that we talked about at VMworld last year. There's Ceph is an object-based storage project being supported by DreamHost, and there's many others. The next steps beyond what's currently mostly there, will soon be there, are to extend this to first a data center scale, and then to federate data centers so that I can say things like, well, DR protect this application and automatically get a replicated copy with appropriate recovery time constraints at a site that's an appropriate distance away. So I say, well, I want to tolerate a disaster with a 100-mile radius. I have to be more than 100 miles away. And then last but not least, if we have these levers of policy-based statements about performance and reliability and capacity and so on, the next step is to, if that's a throttle, like the throttle on your car, the next step is to build a cruise control like your car, which is to say, say what the application behavior should be, the performance should be, and automatically adjust the inputs, the requirements, to deliver that. And then the last area that needs attention, but which is not yet very well developed, is new storage access models beyond our traditional file and block models. Future technologies that are arriving in the near and near future include very low latency persistent memory. In order to exploit this, we can't be spending 50 or 100 microseconds for every access. We need things that are a few microseconds at most. At the same time, in order for this to be reliable storage, it has to be fault tolerant. So that means we have to have some mediation for things like checkpointing. So there's the challenge in especially in software-defined storage, on top of servers that have persistent memory, is how to deliver the value of that persistent memory at low overheads, but while still getting the qualities of reliability and data integrity, even in the presence of application errors, out of that raw resource.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
Hi, I'm Robert Novak, and I think that says it on the next slide. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the evolution of SDS, because that's where we see things developing along some interesting lines. So, some definitions: portability, ubiquity, agnostic, and make it not cast in silicon or hardware. So we have to not only be adaptable to different hardware paradigms, but we also have to hide the different speeds and performances of all the tiers of different storage types. We see basically two fundamental long-term storage types today and some additional caching types, and those are expanding quite rapidly over the next 2-3 years as we get into things like MRAM for persistent non-volatile memories. Policy has to scale out to all the servers, so you define policy once and distributes everywhere. You have to have distributed robustness. You can't be worried about single points of failure anywhere. You have to have centralized administration, not one administrator, but a central pool of administrators. You don't want to visit 100 different machines to administer them. You want to visit one machine to administer all 100 or 1,000, as the case may be. And you have to have very simple disaster recovery, and we'll go into that a little bit more. And by doing all these centralizations, you help to lower both your CapEx and your OpEx costs. Because right now, we see a lot of storage that winds up in silos for different types of storage, different classes of storage, wind up on different machines that have to be administered differently. So, we all started out with on-premise storage, went to multi-premise, and that's where most companies are today. I'm going to talk a little bit about these other 3 points, and we'll cover that in just a second. So we started out with on-premise storage. You put in your first rack, and you built that up to the point where you wound up growing and growing and growing until you're busting at the seams. Then you found out that you needed a whole new facility anyway, and you wound up going into a multi-premise environment. Then you wound up getting smart and putting things off into the cloud so that you could indeed, and I guess I can't get a slide to get its behavior right here. There we go. You get it off into the cloud, and this is the joy of Mac versus PC. Anyway. So let's see if we can get anything up here. It's not going. All right, so the idea is that you now have multi-tenant, and you don't think of files and blocks anymore, you're just thinking about objects, and that's how I've chosen to represent objects in this paradigm. Now you get the disaster recovery case, and of course I just had a disaster and went the wrong way. So when you get the disaster recovery, first you have a disaster, you've wiped out a facility due to a hurricane, a flood, a tornado, power outage, and now you have to set up your employees in an alternate business location or from their homes, and they need to get at their files remotely. Now, if you've just gone off and stored all of your files in an object store, like an S3 store, then you have to rehydrate those files from objects back to files, and that causes a problem. So you have to have a disaster recovery system on your host provider site to rehydrate those. So if you get really smart, you'll wind up having rehydration and replication within your company. So on-premise and multi-premise can operate with silos, but silos don't play well with others when they're migrating into the cloud. We are seeing that applications have been using POSIX semantics, but
applications don't know, don't care, don't want to care about background archiving. And applications believe in infinite storage. This I learned a long time ago, even on IBM 360s with DASD storage and JCL statements. You never had enough storage and you always wanted more. And so all of your devices, including these things, actually believe in infinitely deep storage, so that the 16 gig or so or 80 gig that you've got on your phone should really represent a terabyte or two that's off in the cloud and is just shuffling things back and forth. We believe that fundamentally applications thrive in open source environments. And open source environments create stable APIs and APIs that can respond quickly to migration of user needs. We think that there's going to be a major migration from POSIX to PuTTGET. Now, PuTTGET is just a different way of saying put get, but it's a name so bad you won't forget it. So these devices, your phones and your tablets, will displace your notebooks, your desktops in the user interface environment. And all of those devices are PuTTGET devices. They do not do POSIX open, read, update, write, close, seek operations. So we also believe that you're going to see fundamental changes in the lower end hardware at the back end, going to SMR, shingled magnetic recording, which doesn't handle update at all well, or going to key value drives, which changes the paradigm about how you think about storage that has no location to it in a very different way. But it's going to take a long time. It's going to go both fast and slow. In some ways, it's going to be faster because of this paradigm shift to the BYOD devices. In other ways, you still have to live with your legacy applications. The legacy applications don't change, okay? And they don't die. My favorite example of that is in the city of London in the UK, in the financial district, they still have applications that run financial models that have to convert everything from decimal pounds to pounds, shilling, pence, run the model, and convert back to decimal pounds. And believe me, those applications written in COBOL a century or two ago, that's a little exaggeration, are still running today. So that's the end of what I have to say. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Robert. So if you thought that these two presentations were different, wait till you see all five of them.
Good.
Okay, next is Umesh.
Okay, so good morning. As Ajay said in the beginning, that there's a lot of buzz around software-defined storage, or let's shorten it to SDS. What I'm going to do is try to separate the reality from the hype. Okay? And I'll do this by getting down to the basics and create a framework for how software and hardware interact in modern storage systems. And then in the context of that framework, we can discuss what SDS might mean and what benefits it might have. So let's look at the basic building blocks in a storage ecosystem. On the hardware side, there is the storage media. It does not have much intelligence by itself, often called a JBOD, just a bunch of disks. And I'm showing it here as a pile of disks. But it could be hard disks, could be flash drives, could be internal or external. That's not a fundamental difference. Then we have some compute module, you know, with CPUs and memory and networking, which I'm going to call a blade. The only thing there is that it runs software. On the software side, there's a storage software which controls one or more JBODs and adds all the abilities that we like to see in storage systems. So reliability, availability, scalability, all of that. And finally, there is the application software, which is the consumer of storage. Okay, so given these building blocks, we can visualize the visualize what a storage ecosystem looks like this way. And the key here is that application software, which I show with these icons here, and storage software run on different blades. Okay? So the application software typically talks with storage software over the network using some standard protocol like SCSI or NFS or SMB. And then the storage software connects to the JBODs using SATA, SAS, or PCI. And I'm using colors here to indicate that the components may be purchased from different vendors. So typically, these storage software and the hardware are purchased from the same vendor. The application hardware may be purchased from a different vendor, and the application software may be purchased from yet another vendor. And you'll see why I think this is interesting. But before I go to STS, I want to talk about another concept which I believe is closely related to STS, which you know some might call distributed DAS, as in direct attached storage. Some might call it converged storage. The idea here is that application software and storage software can run on the same set of blades. So this removes the distinction between application nodes and storage nodes. They all look the same now. But notice that this by itself does not reduce the hardware requirements. We still have the same number of disks and the same number of blades. So now I'm ready to define suggest my definition of STS. And I would do it very simply as storage software that can run on a variety of blades and can use a variety of JBODs from different hardware vendors. So notice that this picture here looks very much like converged storage, which I showed on the previous slide. The only thing that's different is the vendorship. You know, the hardware may come from any vendor. Okay, so now that we have that definition, let's get to the meat of STS, which is what benefits it provides. Okay. So it's often considered that with software-defined storage, it'll be easier for the user to pick the right storage software. And I believe that's largely true. You know, the user can download software from one vendor. If they don't like it, they can uninstall it, download the software from another vendor. The only limitation here is that once storage software is in production use, it'll be difficult to swap it out because the data layout depends on the storage software. And one would have to perhaps copy terabytes or petabytes of data. And in this regard, it is different from software-defined networking, where the admin can indeed change the control stack in production use. Okay. So in that regard, SDS is useful, but doesn't go as far as SDN. Okay. Another commonly held belief is that software-defined storage can use commodity hardware, so it should be cheaper, right? I don't think that's true. And the reason is that storage hardware is already commoditized. If you look at modern storage systems, you know, the blades, the JBODs, they're all commodity hardware. And the reality is that the cost, high cost of storage comes not from the hardware, but from the sophisticated storage software and the support that goes along with it. Okay. And in this regard, STS actually makes things a little bit worse, because now the software vendor has to develop with many different hardware in mind, and has to test in more ways, and support can be a nightmare. The third potential benefit is that with software-defined storage, application software and storage software can share blades. So it should be more efficient, right? Just like we get more efficiency out of running many virtual machines on the same host, right? And that would be true if software storage by itself could not fully utilize a blade. The fact is that modern storage software is very compute hungry. And it's getting hungrier because of flash. You know, flash can drive a lot of IOPS, and storage is getting more sophisticated with data reduction, compression, deduplication, lots of new functionality being added there. All of that is compute heavy, and at least in my experience, it can consume all the compute you can throw at it. So there isn't that kind of efficiency to be gained by sharing software storage and application software, storage software and application software on the same plane. Okay, finally, some people claim that software-defined storage would be more scalable, right? So I believe it's true that it's generally scalable, because if it has to be scalable. If it's not scalable, then you'll be stuck with direct attached storage. And that's not very useful. You have to reach out to the storage attached to other nodes. But that doesn't mean you have to have SDS to have scale out. In fact, the same mechanisms that SDS can use for scale out can be perfectly used by modular storage to do scale out as well. And in fact, Isilon from EMC is a great example of that. So, to conclude, what I believe is that there are some true benefits of SDS. They are mostly around flexibility to the user in procuring and picking the right storage. But many of the other benefits that are attributed to SDS are either not true or are orthogonal to whether it's software defined or not. Okay, so that's it.
Thanks, Shemesh. Next up, we have Jay. And
still says draft.
Thanks, AJ. Yeah, so this isn't actually a draft. This is final. Don't worry. So, probably like many of you, I find software-defined storage to be a pretty fuzzy concept. So, to prepare for this panel, I did what any school kid does these days, and I went to Wikipedia. So here's what the lead sentence in the Wikipedia entry is. Which I think is actually fairly apt. But to be a little more serious, I want to give my quick take here on what I think the kind of key features and benefits of software-defined storage are. I was going to say that I expect these are pretty similar to the views of the rest of the panelists in the audience, but after Umesh, I'm not so sure. I guess that's why we do these panels. So in my view, the key features of software-defined storage are one, commodity hardware. Moving more of the intelligence and innovation into the software kind of is implicit in the name. Something that comes from the sister concept of software-defined networking is separation of control and data planes. This is a design pattern that we actually think is quite important, leads to several of the benefits that I'll list in a moment. And then third, the third major thing is open API-based provisioning and management. Again, putting the software front and center around fairly generic hardware. So the benefits that I see coming out of this are, first, economies of scale and the cost savings that come from commodity hardware and kind of genericization there. Second, Again, cost savings and similar benefits that come from vendor diversity and competition, right? So separating the control and data plane is one thing that allows multiple vendors to focus on the pieces that they are good at instead of having a more monolithic solution. So again, something that brings competition in there. Third, agility and elasticity. It gets pretty hard to argue that hardware is more elastic than software. And then finally, something important to us is location independence. So this is kind of topological separation of where data is housed versus where it's accessed or created. Again, putting software in place gives many more degrees of freedom to hide latency, apply various techniques, and separating control and data plane also opens up the playing field there some. So that's my take on software-defined storage. I actually want to spend the second part of my mini talk here on a kind of a neighboring topic, which is, I believe, enabled by software-defined storage, but from a customer point of view, is actually much more important. And that's the concept of storage as a service. You know, can I provision, consume, retire storage without having to go through a excruciating capacity planning exercise, lengthy procurement cycles, and a massive upfront outlay of cash in order to get my storage? And I think the answer here is actually pretty good. Yes, you can get storage as a service today, and I think it's only going to get better. I've listed here some options for kind of the main use cases or classes of enterprise storage. I'm not going to talk about kind of VM storage or database as a service, but I am going to take a minute to talk about, and this is kind of the shameless plug part of the talk, file system as a service, which is a capability that our product enables. So we at Maginatics, we have a product called MagFS, and this is a walkthrough of how a customer can get file system as a service, no explicit hardware involved. Of course, hardware is underneath. So kind of the preliminary steps, the one-time preliminary steps, are provisioning on the customer's virtualization platform, and we support VMware, Amazon EC2, other virtualization platforms coming. A couple of VMs for management purposes, right? And then on the endpoint side, the end user device side, we have an agent that runs on each end user device, gets installed once. We support kind of all the major operating systems and device types ranging from phones and tablets up to multi-core servers. So then the part that gets deployed when you actually need to add capacity, want to consume storage, is again, some VMs on the customer's infrastructure that we call virtual filer or virtual filer head. These are VMs which perform the functionality of a traditional physical filer head, and they're coupled with object storage that represents the kind of traditional body of a filer. And that can come from many different sources. Both customer can choose public, private, or combination. A whole bunch of logos there, pretty much all of the object storage vendors, talking to Nexenta as well. So that's all the provisioning that's required. And then users access the storage over a split control and data plane via the agent on our that's deployed on the endpoints. And there you have it. It utilizes commodity hardware, split control and data plane, and open management. So software-defined storage in the context of a file system as a service. So that's my pitch.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay.
Thanks, Jay. Next up is David.
Okay. So
This is really interesting. I'm standing up here last to go, and I'm reminded of that old line from Monty Python, and now for something completely different. AJ has done the interesting move of letting a network fox into the storage hen house. I hope you like what I have to say. I've done work in both storage and networking, and this whole software-defined concept has originated out of the networking space, so I thought I'd spend a little bit of time talking about what can we learn from software-defined networking. They're farther along than software-defined storage is. What's happened there? What's going on? Now, I need to put a piece of scope here. AJ only gave me about 5 to 10 minutes, so I'm going to focus on data centers, because software-defined networking in data centers turns out to be very, very different from long-distance, wide-area networking carrier software-defined networking. And so if you look at software-defined networking in the data centers and ask, what can we learn from it, I think there's three lessons. Number one, the goal is services and automation, not programmability, not implementation. Number two, the focus. It's the control plane, stupid. Jay talked about data control separation. The action here is the control plane, not the data plane, and not the management plane. And the future, how do we know we're going to get there? Watch for common control protocols. System-specific interfaces aren't enough. They won't enable the benefits that you hear everybody talking about. So let me go through these three points in a little more detail. Okay, the goal is services and automation, not programmability and implementation. If you look at software-defined networking, they started out by making network switches programmable. They effectively went to the switches, took the side cover off the packet forwarding path and says, ooh, we can program this. Great research project. Won't get deployed in most data centers because most data centers aren't going to let you do arbitrary programming of their switches. Oh, by the way, storage is the same way. Most data centers won't let you arbitrary program their storage. So what's going on here? Well, in data centers, software-defined networking has delivered a technology that we refer to as network virtualization. Now, even this one's a little bit misleading because the big deal is not that we've actually virtualized the network in another layer of indirect abstraction. We do this all the time. The big difference is we now have automation as a major, major benefit. What's being delivered in these network virtualization technologies is the ability to configure the network in the next 5 minutes, not next Sunday afternoon. And policy is coming into play to enable this kind of orchestration of configuration in an environment without needing guru class skills. Oh, by the way, software defined does not mean software implemented. This is about the control plane. If you think software defined means software implemented, take a modern network interface card, turn off TCP segmentation offloads, and see if you like your performance. You'll learn quickly. Okay, second, this is about the control plane. The biggest thing that SDN brought and enables network virtualization to have the impact it's having and change the world is they functionally consolidated the control plane. You actually now have a functionally centralized, I'm emphasizing functionally here because implementation is very distributed, ability to control and orchestrate the entire network. Powerful automation scale. Now, people point out, look, I said network virtualization. These guys did some stuff with the data plane. Yeah, had a few minor problems need to be fixed. Oops, the .1q VLAN tag is only 12 bits. Congratulations, it's a networking version of 640K memory limit in DOS. And if we want routing, let's use real IP routing. But these are enablers. The action here is in the control plane, and the same is going on in storage. You'll hear about people say, we've got to do things in the storage plane. Storage control plane is block, file, object. Yeah, not everything speaks object. We need to do some things there. But it's about the control plane. How do you configure and organize the storage resources in an environment to get things done? Beyond that, we then get up to the management plane, and what you're seeing happen in management is what we think of the management plane is now really turning into a combination of management and orchestration. You see a lot of environments, I'll use OpenStack as an example, that are putting in place this orchestration layer, and that's the evolution of the management plane. But the action for software-defined is really in the control plane. Finally, how do we tell we're getting there? The answer is common control protocols. System-specific interfaces don't cut it. Now, I have a PhD. I spent time in grad school. Unfortunately, this is not something that they teach in grad school research environments, and I'll tell you why. The problem out in the real world is that system-specific drivers and plugins, if you'll pardon the French, are more SH bleep and CR bleep junk you have to install, upgrade, manage, configure, and break, and troubleshoot, and da-da-da-da. Every additional piece you add in the environment adds complexity. In a research environment, not a big deal. Anybody know how many professors it takes to change a light bulb? None. That's what graduate students are for. And that's a problem when you try to work on this because there aren't any graduate students in data centers. So better approach here. Make light bulbs somebody else's problem. This isn't just me pontificating. It's happening in practice. You can see it other places. Here's an example that you never expected. We have companies, mine included, that take applications that are designed to run an entire server. This thing's going to soup to nuts and consume all the hardware and everything there, and it's the only thing runs on it. We package and ship this thing as a virtual machine, and we run a hypervisor. Why? Operating system device drivers are light bulbs. We make them somebody else's problem, like VMware's. And this is what applies. This is a principle that's going to apply to getting the software-defined storage. We're going to need to be looking towards common control protocols. You see this happening in the software-defined networking world. Protocols to do this in the control plane are emerging. OpenFlow was the first one. There's now quite a bit of action around a protocol called OVSDB. These are the control plane protocols that enable software-defined networking. So if you want to see how close we are to getting there, where are the common control protocols for software-defined storage? There's been an attempt made with SIM and SMIS. Maybe that'll come back. There's OpenStack Cinder. That might be a foundation. And by the way, I heard Jay say something about APIs. What's going to happen here is that the API protocol distinction is starting to go away because a REST API is fundamentally a protocol, and what you think of as a REST-based API could turn into these common protocols. So appreciate you spending the time here. Listen to me. So the three things within software-defined networking is the goal is services and automation. What does this enable? The focus is on the control plane. That's where the big change is that makes a difference. And watch for the future. Look for common control protocols to emerge to displace the plethora of system-specific interfaces we have today. Thank you very much.
Okay, I think we can start with thanking all the panelists for a great set of slides and talking through some of these things. So now we begin the next part of the panel discussion where...
I might want to get my logo off the screen.
Where you're welcome to ask questions to the panelists, and please come up to the mic and state your name and affiliation when you ask the question.
Hi, Eric Riddell from EMC. So I think start with Jay. The your control plane versus data plane distinction. Where's the metadata? Do you keep everything in the object storage, or if those filers go belly up, then you forgot where all your data is?
So in our system, the metadata is on the other end of the control plane from the end user, right? So is a separation of metadata and data is completely analogous to separation of control and data plane in our system.
So the metadata is a third thing?
Well, so the metadata is stored in the virtual machines or whatever backs the virtual machines. Yeah.
So one interesting thing that I heard that in case of software-defined networking, it seems like we got the SDN first and then we are doing network virtualization. But in case of storage virtualization seems to be already there for a long time. And now we are going towards software-defined storage. What do you see is the role of storage virtualization here? Is that something which is done, or is that going to evolve as well?
I view storage virtualization as fundamentally residing in the data plane. As AJ points out, we've done it for a very long time, all the way back to logical volume managers. If you look at basic RAID techniques, all of those are storage virtualization. It's primarily data plane. I think we're going to see an evolution towards something else, and we probably won't call it storage virtualization because we have all this stuff around. We're definitely going to see some kind of much better flexibility and orchestration enabled by the control plane, and maybe that orchestration word will become the key word for the service that's enabled by software-defined storage.
Anybody?
I'd have to go to Wikipedia and look up storage virtualization.
Okay. See what the market people did with it?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Amish.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, storage virtualization has been around for a long time. In fact, probably longer than most people think. You know, people think that it's now in the context of virtual machines that, you know, storage for virtual machines is storage virtualization. But really, you know, as soon as we created LUNs from physical disks, you know, aggregated them and carved them out, that's when storage virtualization started. And it's a long road. I think there are many things that can be done on storage virtualization. And Bill mentioned quite a few of those. But I wouldn't want to pile up all of the stuff that can be done for storage virtualization into this new concept of software-defined storage. And I would like to keep the definition crisp. That is one, and the second about software-defined storage is that I think the analogies to software-defined networking are limited. You know, we shouldn't take that analogy too far, necessarily. It's not a good perfect analogy, at least.
Not perfect.
We should make it useful, you know, useful for the users. And it should be a well-defined concept, otherwise it'll mean everything.
I think same as people said about the cloud, that it started to mean everything, right. And now it means nothing.
But I think right. That we've had networking virtualization around for a lot longer than we had SDN.
I see. That is true as
VLANs
well.
VLANs have been there forever. I mean, that sort of thing has been evolving for a long period of time.
Yeah,
we're probably a little bit early on the evolution to SDS, but I think David made an excellent point that the REST APIs might be the right kind of paradigm that we should be looking at, because when you think of S3 REST APIs, you don't think anything at all about volumes, disk drives, capacity. You just get and put what you need, and you assume that someone has an infinitely deep storage array that will instantly respond whenever you need it. Unfortunately, it's across a WAN. So if you can do the same thing within your data center, now you're on to something that's very powerful.
Yep. So I guess it seems to me that there's more than just control APIs. In other words, it's one thing to say I have a protocol that lets me express the policy that I want. You know, make me a chunk of storage so big, so fast, that's all very well. That's just an API. Something underneath has to do the work. And so I guess I disagree that the control plane is everything. I mean, in some sense, you can argue that the control plane is responsible for taking pieces down below and putting them together, but the data plane actually has to make all those things work for real. If it's just simply redirecting you to some particular disk drive, that's not fault-tolerant storage with those manageability properties that I was outlining in terms of being able to automatically migrate to different places and so on. So there's real work in the data plane to make reliable, robust, manageable storage happen.
Hi, Tim Wood from George Washington University. So one of the things that interests me about software-defined storage is that now we have a new abstraction layer where we can add new services. So I'm curious about having multiple layers of this. So how do you see this evolving where we're going to have many different servers storage services that we're combining in new ways? Is that just lots of overhead? Is there interoperability issues that we have to worry about? How is that going to impact how all of this evolves?
Can I start?
Yeah, sure.
So you can take two views about how we would supply a given more abstract service. Like, suppose I want to have a arbitrarily scalable key value store, you know, quadrillions of entries, accessible from anywhere. Well, I could build that out of raw disk drives, and some people have. But alternately, I could take the view that, well, I'm building this as on top of a common infrastructure, and so what I might build it on top of are abstract storage objects that are maybe block-type objects, where the underlying one layer handles the care and feeding of the physical devices and abstracts them, and then another layer does the higher level data structures on top of those chunks of resource. And the chunks of resource may be tied to particular physical locations, but not to particular physical devices or boxes. So one could, and so I believe that actually, while for particular special cases, a thing that's top to bottom all the way down to the lowest level of physical hardware and handles all of those problems in one place is realistic. Certainly, certain large companies pulled this off. For most people, where they simply want it provisioned on demand, that layers of abstraction where a given layer handles one part of the problem and doesn't try to handle every part of the problem is appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe part of my concern is if a higher up layer now doesn't know whether you're using SSDs or hard drives, I mean, that's a huge difference in terms of what the low levels are doing. So how much information is going to need to be exposed between layers?
Yeah, so that's the point where if we have well-defined policy requirements for what a given object that upper layer wants to consume, and that the lower level then delivers that quality of service, not just, well, it's a time-sharing slice, one-nth of this storage array, but rather it's actual a promise about how good, how fast it is, and how reliable it is, and so on. Then the upper layer can treat that as an abstraction of a storage device that's maybe not SSD or maybe not a disk drive, but something that has some properties in between, whatever is cost effective for that use case. So more about saying, how much latency do you need? Can you tolerate? Are you favoring bandwidth? Are you favoring IOPS? You know, what are your requirements? And then let the lower level storage system make that up out of all the different kinds of resources, including the coming non-volatile memory.
Hi, Peter Desnoyers, Northeastern. This is a question across the panel, and it touches on things that a few of you said, including Umesh. So clearly, you know, if you went to a marketing talk for a big storage array, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you would have heard most but not all of these ideas and features described. So I guess what I'm still trying to get my head around is to what extent, you know, what aspects of what's being called software-defined storage today are different from what you could do with, you know, vendor X's large array 15 years ago or 10 years ago, and are those differences, and also are those differences technical differences or are they business use, you know, business case differences, because those are both real, they're just very different for us as technical people. So like AJ's comment about cloud, there's a fairly good business case definition of it. It's just it raises unrelated technical questions.
Okay, so I guess I'll pick that one up since I'm from one of those large vendors, and I think we were building those large arrays 15 years ago. I think the biggest change is to start by asking, what was the state of the art storage management tool for managing sort of the storage capacity and resource off a large array 15 years ago? It was a spreadsheet. How long did it take to get it? I put the joke up there about next Sunday afternoon for networking. That's actually fairly responsive if you're dealing with, at that point in time, if you're dealing with an enterprise critical array where if you get it wrong, the business consequences in terms of what you can't do and the revenue you lose are massive. And I think that's the biggest change that we're getting from, that we are moving from a world in which very careful, very controlled, quasi-static configuration into a much more dynamic resource provisioning, orchestration, management change world, and that's what you see on the networking side. It's the biggest thing of software defined networking enabled, and I think it's coming to storage. I think that's the major difference.
So, would it be safe to say that essentially autonomic capabilities?
You've been talking to the marketers again, haven't you?
Well, there was a whole conference call here called that. So. Thank you.
Perhaps one of the things that we have to look at is how the market shifted in the last 15 years. If you installed a storage system within a corporation 15 years ago, you were worried about things like departmental billing for who was using how much storage. And that was because it was a very scarce commodity. Storage isn't free, but it's getting a lot cheaper. Although we're expanding our use of it by a lot more, than it's dropping in price. But at the same time, people are really thinking in terms of an infinite storage. You don't want to think about how much it costs you to store things on your tablet and have that deep, deep storage off on the network. So this is just your cache of what you're using. The REST APIs are a step in the right direction. You've abstracted away from, you're not thinking about, oh, is that storage on a disk drive? Is it on a spinning disk? Is it on a flash disk? Is it a RAM memory? You don't care. You just want capacity. And you want it now, and you don't want to think about it. And that's what we're moving to more and more. And that's where the big shift is coming, is because of the user expectation about how that happens without having to worry about too much of the control plane, that most of that should disappear into the network, literally.
One of the key differences is how long it takes to get something done. In many cases, in a traditional enterprise environment, the way you get new storage for this new application is you send in a help desk ticket to the storage team, and it might get handled, because of the things that David talks about, in weeks, because they're doing risk management, or maybe they had to order equipment or whatever. So the ability to get things done is very slow. The opportunity with software-defined storage, as with software-defined networking, is to get it, to separate those delivery concerns, mainly to automate them, and from the consumption concern. So the consumer simply says, give it to me now, like when you say, give me an Amazon VM.
Yeah, so I wasn't working at a storage company 15 years ago, but I I think the main things that have changed since then are new things are, one, the rise of object store as a kind of viable alternative building block, and I think, as Bill was just alluding to also, provisioning and deployment of storage as a service, right? The cloud provider is taking the lead in that now, but also that filtering its way into enterprises and service that IT offers to internal customers.
Okay, actually, I would like to add something too.
Which is closer?
Okay,
Mike.
So, yeah, I guess I could characterize all of what we are saying is that storage virtualization has been getting better over the last many years, right? So we have had LUNs for a long time, but it's only now that it's better able to hide the underlying implementation, right? It's now that the user doesn't have to care about which level of RAID maybe or how much storage there is, and is better able to specify the requirements as opposed to worry about what's underneath. So that's how I would characterize it. So there are lots of things being done for improving storage virtualization. Lots have been done, and lots have yet to be done. But I wouldn't, as I said earlier, put all of that in the basket of software-defined storage. That's all.
So then, for the old networking people, it's the difference between a bridge and a switch.
Yeah, right.
No.
I was going to say, they do the same thing. It's just, you know, one's at some point you start calling it the different name because it's better.
Really? You might want to talk to the data center folks about the difference between routing and bridging. I'm sure they can educate you.
No, okay. I mean the early switches.
I'm not sure if this helps the discussion, but I was thinking that perhaps another way or another dimension to look at software-defined storage versus many of the other things that we've been talking about, including storage virtualization, is using use cases, right? So in your view, what are the new capabilities that you expect software-defined storage to add to the data center, right? Or is it more along the lines of enhancing existing capabilities, making them easier to manage, and so on. So is it like fundamentally new use cases that software-defined storage enables? Does it make the data center administrator's job go away in any way, or does it make it easier? Do we have fewer admins now? So I'm looking at the application here as opposed to the policy versus mechanism control data plane issues.
Okay, try take a shot at this and go somewhere. I think you've heard some of the use cases. I'm thinking about Bill's remarks in particular and the discussion around abstraction. I think composition of services becomes a new use case that's enabled by the much richer control plane functionality. Taking some storage that you've pulled off of somewhere and saying, okay, let's go apply a backup service to this. Or let's go take this and tick a box here, and now I've got replication off to another recovery zone. That's stuff that is, all the building blocks have been around in terms of the mechanics of the services, but the ability to put them together and to think about, I can do this, and that kind of composition. This is a place where 5 minutes versus 5 hours versus 5 days makes a massive difference in realization of the use case. It takes me 5 days to add this kind of add-on. It becomes much less interesting than if I can get it in the next 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's so much about new use cases as reducing friction in existing use cases, right? Ability to consume resources with less overhead, less effort, to be less bound by latency and topology as well.
One key thing I think is self-service. Some of VMware's large customers have implemented essentially full self-service portals internally, like what you can get by deploying a VM at Amazon, except it's a whole catalog of applications. And you just say, well, you know, I want a little database for my department. And you can pick one of several, and it gets you a VM ready to run with backup and all those things bundled into it. So it's the kind of thing that Dave was talking about. Only you don't have to say any of that thing. Someone already has made a template, and you just instantiate it. And that's makes the whole business run way more ably. You didn't have to order up a database creation from some IT organization. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, it does reduce the amount of IT staff to provide a given level of service. But it isn't so much, I don't know that it'll really reduce the number of people working in that space. What it'll improve is what the business can get done every year.
On a related line, if you start looking at the evolution of the use cases, moving from, actually file services came about long before block services. Block services were often to serve database applications, and now we have object. And what we saw was a migration where you bought one system for filing, another system for block, and now another system for object. There's no need for that. You should buy one set of hardware that has a software-defined storage layer that lets you access files, blocks, or objects all with the same paradigm, or not the same API interface, but with a seamless way to talk in any one of those three languages for your applications.
When I'm hearing the talk, there seems to be some confusion between I'm having software-defined storage and elasticity, and it's like it makes it sound as if I install software and I got elasticity for my storage, which is not the case unless I use a cloud provider. And if that's the case, then I'm hearing the usage of REST as an API as potentially is high-performance storage, I would say. So I'm not seeing that happening. I mean, we're talking protocols with high overhead and over high latency link. So they're just something that doesn't compute, I guess, for me. So do you have anything to say about that? Or?
Well, so I guess, I mean, there clearly are people who have done that. Well, in other words, Amazon S3 is essentially that model. But yeah, it's not high. It's high. That's a high latency example. Mm-hmm. For low latency storage, we in fact need interfaces that are probably lower overhead than the ones we have today, not higher. To be able to really exploit persistent memory, for example, we'll need much lower latency, lower overhead interfaces. I think what David was mostly talking about were control interfaces. Like, well, how does you say, give me this chunk of storage, this big, this fast? Mm-hmm. That's, a REST API is a perfectly fine way of saying it. It's a general connection thing. The data access path, though, clearly has to be far more optimized for most of the data types we'd care about.
Yeah, a REST API does not have to be a high overhead item. It can translate very directly into lower level APIs that get you right to the storage within a local data center that can provide the elasticity that you need. That WAN elasticity is only a place of last resort for your backups, for recovery, for overflow when you can't get hardware shipped in fast enough to meet your elastic growth needs.
Yeah, I would agree with everything being said here, and Bill is absolutely correct. When I mentioned REST APIs, that was primarily control path, although as has been pointed out, the Amazon S3 interface is a REST API for put and get, rather high overhead. The flip side is that, remember what I said about software defined does not mean software implemented? You will see hardware optimizations in the data paths, and you'll see more and more of them, and they sometimes result in really interesting things. I can take the opportunity to tell a story not many people know. For block storage, the most common access protocols are based around SCSI. SCSI or fiber channel or iSCSI or serial attached SCSI. And hardware people have been optimizing the daylights out of them. The HBAs do very, very fast direct memory access, move things very, very quickly. And this has very interesting side effects. When IBM was re-engineering mainframe storage access, which doesn't use SCSI, it uses a completely different model, and they wanted to make it faster, they actually bent over backwards, did some very, very clever things, so that if you look on the wire at the current generation of FICON, which is, they call it high-performance FICON, it's the new generation of what is used for mainframe storage access all over the place. The data framing on the wire and the way they do it looks enough like SCSI over fiber channel that they can use the same hardware. And so the hardware continues to matter a great deal in the storage access path, and there's a surprising example.
I would add just two things about performance. It's not just the overhead in a particular exchange, and obviously REST has quite a bit of overhead built in, but other factors are often important, right? It can be the number of exchanges you make, right? How clever is your protocol in compounding, batching, and so on, right? I mean, we have cases where 500 NFS operations are effectively compounded into one operation, right? The REST overhead is you know, negligible in that case. The other is how parallelizable is does the protocol allow the system to be, right? I mean, there's examples out there with, you know, from many of them from Google and then now through Hadoop and which show that, you know, kind of brute force parallelism can overcome a lot of kind of individual overheads.
Okay, maybe I'll add a little bit to this. That I think that the differences between protocols may be less fundamental than they might seem in terms of how well they can perform and how scalable they might be. So the difference that is there is that some protocols provide more semantic information to flow from the application to storage, and some less. So those that provide more semantic information, and I do believe that object and NAS and you know those kind of protocols can provide more information than block based. That's the only difference I see.
Just to follow up on my previous question. I'd like to go back to something that I think Umesh said during his presentation, which is, well, one of the analogies with software-defined networking is the ability to allow different vendors to interoperate. And if you bring that to storage, we are talking about allowing different storage vendors to interoperate. So first of all, do you think, do you agree with that? And if you do, then the follow-up question is, well, presumably every vendor has their own secret sauce in how they manage various things like performance and reliability and whatnot. What in your mind are controls that vendors could comfortably expose without revealing such secret sauces? While at the same time making the interoperability actually useful in terms of building something like a management layer that binds everything together. I know this is a very open-ended question, but I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Okay, I could go first. So I think what's possible is for different storage stacks to run on the same hardware, okay? Not necessarily at the same time, but the user at least could have the flexibility of using one stack versus the other, right? And the problem is that you can, you know, once you have data stored based on one stack, then it's difficult to move to another stack. But at least in trying to figure out which stack you want, you could run it that way. And to some extent, based on the protocols, there's already some interoperability in the sense that you can read data from one stack and write to another stack. What could be done better is, you know, the things like replication, for example. You know, there's currently no standard way of replicating data from one stack to another. Okay. It needs to all go through the host in the form of reads and writes. So it's I think there is some work yet to be done, but already you know there are certain things that are possible.
So just to clarify, I'm thinking of more generic knobs that are functionality independent and that you can use to, for instance, build different kinds of functionality such as replication and fault tolerance and performance, maybe.
So I think we need to start by going back and talking about separation of the control and data planes and what's going on in each of them. We've done a decent job on some aspects of data plane interoperability. iSCSI client in servers tends to talk to everybody's iSCSI storage. NFS client tends to talk to anybody's NFS file server. the opportunity is to start doing something similar in the control plane. And I mean, the common data plane protocols have not stopped people from doing innovative things in the implementation behind that. And a level of commonality on the control plane won't stop people from doing innovative things, but it'll provide a baseline that works across systems from a variety of vendors. So I don't view that as a barrier to innovation and differentiation.
So there are some issues that to our efforts so far in terms of common control plane, some of the things that David alluded to are, you know, SMIS and so on, yeah, are necessarily not exactly lowest common denominator, but they're close. They're not very sophisticated. The reason in part is that if there's not yet consensus to move forward on higher level capabilities, many vendors will be reluctant to support adding them to the standard because then they'll not be conformant. So there's a challenge here if you're thinking in terms of making a lot of existing implementations talk together, that basically it's a trailing effort, not a leading effort. For example, in disk drives and SSDs, there's things like smart data. There's a little bit of it standardized and a great deal that's not. It's vendor specific. Now on hard disk drives, that's actually gotten less so. There's fewer vendors and they've cooperated, but SSDs are still the Wild West with lots of innovation and unfortunately very little standardization in a lot of the control plane aspects of the drives. It's not a problem for a hardware vendor who buys some one drive and sticks it in their storage array, but it's not a big problem, it's a manageable problem. But if you wanted to have generic software that talks to every vendor of SSD, it's a big problem if you actually want to do any sophisticated management. Well, the problem gets much worse when we're talking about higher level storage arrays or other storage subsystems that are more sophisticated and have more capabilities to be able to define an abstraction that everyone can agree to, especially if some of them know that they won't be able to implement all the pieces right away.
Along a similar line, you know, we talked about the REST APIs earlier. The REST APIs are just a representation of an API class. You don't have to implement the API itself via HTTP. You can do it with other lower level APIs that give you the capability. But there's things that are emerging in the way you manage the data. For example, even at the object level, you may have a replication count for the object. Most systems today require that you manage the replication count on a bucket basis so that it's across a whole set of users. But there's actually data that requires that the data is replicated 3 times, 5 times, 10 times, or on every server for certain classes of data. But we don't have a good way of expressing that. So those are the types of control plane aspects that we need to abstract into consistent APIs at that control plane level that can then influence how specific vendors of both hardware and software apply their own secret sauce to make the magic happen to provide the best performance for that.
Great, thanks.
Hi, I'm Janice Deesa from NetApp. So I think we've talked about SSDs versus hard drives in terms of latency. And I think you mentioned that, you know, if you exposed the differences up the stack, maybe you could choose what you wanted in terms of latency. But my question is, what about characteristics of SSDs like write amplification and designing different file system layouts based on the properties of flash versus hard drives? So are we ready to virtualize the entire stack yet?
Well, various of us are working on doing that, virtualizing the storage objects with pieces underneath. For example, EMC's VMAX product or Symmetrix product has automatic storage tiering that hides the fact that there's non-volatile memory, there's flash drives, there's magnetic disk drives, and gives you an abstract LUN with a set of properties. And we can carry that idea much further, and my project's trying to do that as well. By virtualizing the objects, that we can let the storage system do mix and match the underlying resources to deliver the overall behavior that's specified. So we needed, we do need an abstract definition of what's required that's not tied to some particular technology. Write amplification is something that can be dealt with reasonably at a block storage level, if you pay attention to what the workload characteristics are. That's actually one of the challenges in storage, in making storage virtualization or software-defined storage be really effective, is that today we don't have good ways of automatically capturing the behavior of a workload. There's some starts at that, but that's actually one of the things that that kind of cruise control thing I alluded to really make that work well, we'll have to observe the workload characteristics rather than asking the user to tell us what they are. So if we observe them, then we can properly say, well, this piece of the data belongs on a flash drive today, tomorrow on solid-state memory, and this other piece, which is kind of cold data, can perfectly well be on the magnetic disks.
Yeah, along the same lines, my company, Nimble Storage, is working on exactly what you're talking about. We may have hard disk and flash drives in a system, and to the user, it looks like a single tier of storage, you know, which has good performance as well as good capacity. And they can, the system takes care of many of the things automatically, including the fact that flash has limited write endurance and also relatively low write performance. All of those things are taken care of transparently. But the user can specify whether they want, they can specify at a high level whether they want more performance or less, and that can, the system automatically takes care of those directions.
Isn't what you're talking about is basically defining, as Bill alluded to, the quality of service that the user wants.
That's right.
So that quality of service has been well expressed in software-defined networking. So you have QoS so that a VoIP or a streaming movie has a different quality of service than a background data fetch for HDFS. Okay, so that's coming across the network. So that we have to abstract out to that quality of service as the paradigm that the application is expressing, or as Bill pointed out, that we observe the behavior to infer a quality of service that's required for that data. And that's the paradigm that we have to work to. The more we can make that transparent so the user doesn't have to express it as a quality of service, the more that we can abstract it in terms of observed behavior and then have responsive storage that migrates the data to non-volatile memory as opposed to volatile flash storage that has write problems and wear problems, then you're getting into the right kinds of paradigms. And that's part of the abstraction layer that we're building up so that we're taking, as David pointed out, a combination of the storage characteristics and the network characteristics for how the traffic's moving in order to build that observed behavior.
So I guess I want to say a couple of things. First of all, I hear some criticisms being made of flash, which are correct for the raw technology. If you look at the raw flash chips, sure enough, they've got write endurance problems and the like. Raw flash chips are not what goes into modern storage systems. What goes into those systems are flash drives. Drives have very, very smart controllers in the drives, and there's some additional smart software. I mean, when EMC first brought out flash drives and enterprise storage systems, we had effectively no field failures from write wear out because you can put the wear leveling software in there. So what's going on with flash is, yes, you can talk raw technology, but you have to go look at the stack. Other thing I would do is basically strongly agree with what's being said here, because the danger in optimizing for flash in particular is you can lock yourself into a place you don't want to be. The right now, if you're looking at cost of capacity, hard drives, SATA drives in particular, are much cheaper than flash. And this is not going to change the next 5 years. 5 years from now, a gigabyte on a large SATA drive is still going to be significantly cheaper than a gigabyte of flash. And so this means that you should only be optimizing for flash for the very, very small cases where you absolutely positively know that you need what only flash can deliver, which is very, 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 very high I/O operation density on some concentrated data. And lots of people get this wrong. An example, we have had non-volatile memory in our enterprise storage arrays for something like two decades. The fundamental architecture of a large EMC box is that there's this enormous non-volatile cache that vaults a disk on power fail and writes complete to cache, not drives. We have had in the very early days, I mean, lots of people do this, from the very early days, we've had the ability to lock things in cache. We find that when we allow customers to lock things in cache, 80% of the time, the stuff they lock into cache reduces overall system performance because they actually don't have the detailed global understanding of what's really hot and what isn't. And the auto-tiering code that I think was referred to earlier, and you find it in lots of people in the industry, simply does a better job of that resource management, and you ought to leave that code do its job.
Okay. I think I'd like to see that in the description of, where at some point that stack diverges a little bit, whether you're working on flash or hard drive with some algorithms of what's hot and what's not. So I think that would be nice to include in the definition.
So I think we'll take one more question since we are almost out of time, but I would like to make a comment on the previous question. I think this is one hot area for research where I feel every year we have a lot of papers. They basically try to either improve the hit rate on flash or improve the flash performance or flash scheduling. Same kind of papers we have seen for disk in the past. And I think one analogy that I would like to make, what Bill said, is I think what is hard is to build the cruise control. Optimizing one particular thing for one particular workload is interesting, but it's a relatively less harder problem than building a cruise control where you are sizing these things on the fly. Okay. Next question.
Albert Chen, Western Digital. So most of the panelists are from storage enclosure companies, so they are quite close to the host. At WD, at the disk level we're working at, as Umesh was mentioning, there's less semantic information. So at least you get, if you're using file access, at least you know what files access, but by the time it gets to disk, all we get is you're accessing LBA 50. And it's like, what is that, right? And or if we get an error, we will try to recover it, trying to spend many times trying to rewrite it, try to read it as much as we can. While at upper level, you might know that you have another copy somewhere else. So when's the time to share some of this love, some of this smarts down to the very bottom device level so that we have some more context information so it could help, overall storage performance and fault tolerance to work better?
I guess there is a reason IBM moved out of disk business, but go ahead, Amish.
I was going to say, was there a question in there? Well, I share your pain because our large SAN arrays provide the virtual disk abstractions with all of the feature limitations you described.
Yeah, I agree with the concern. I don't think that all of the semantic information needs to flow down all the way to the disk level. So much of the intelligence is in the storage software that's running at a system level, maybe outside of the disk. And indeed, it can, when it gets an error from one disk, it can fix that error using RAID parity. So it's not clear to me that it all needs to flow down to the very basic level. What is useful is for the storage system as a system to get as much semantic information from the application as possible. So there it helps for the storage system to be aware of files as opposed to blocks.
If it's used in your box, for example, it does automatic tiering. For example, in a hybrid drive, we're also trying to make things react a lot more in the flash.
Yeah, that's why I think that hybrid disk drives may be good, you know, in desktops or laptops. But in a storage system, with many drives that can have separate hard disk drives and flash drives, they can do that, you know, they can be hybrid without having hybrid disk drives.
There are some controls, including on Western Digital drives, that storage systems can and sometimes do use to, for example, time-limited error recovery to say, well, don't work too hard on read errors, mm-hmm. and because I know I'm going to fix it for you. So those are still fairly limited. And we also don't have really good ways to say priority. For the most part, every request is the same, and we have to jump through hoops to avoid having a priority inversion, a bunch of writes queued and then a read comes in. We can't tell the drive, this read's more important than those writes. We can sort of do it, but there's some kludges to do it, but mostly we can't. And so there's things where, unfortunately, there's a chicken and egg problem. Drive manufacturers don't want to add these features if no one's going to use them. And of course, storage vendors can't very well use them if they don't exist. So that's one of the challenges is how we can break the logjam on adjusting the API, which of course has been very stable for a long time.
So Hope, this is a very quick question. Jay from Western Digital. Anybody think about the cost of ownership or cost of use for the SDS? Because I think one of the panelists mentioned about the not saving the money. And this one, the other one is that from the food chain, is the cloud service provider or the enterprise user or the average user like you and me should pay more attention to the SDS paradigm?
That wasn't a short question.
Let's see where to start. The CapEx and OpEx concerns are very real. We believe firmly that software-defined storage is a way of reducing both of those costs by allowing you to unify multiple storage models within the same hardware paradigms that are portable across multiple platforms. We have expenses in making that happen, as other people have mentioned, but that's an ongoing challenge, and I'll just leave it at that.
So just quickly, I think, again, SDS is really more of an enabler. It's a service model that I think gets you into the scale regions where costs change dramatically. And the other thing SDS does, though, I think is it to the extent that it opens up the playing field to more vendors and more competition, then that also drives down costs. But fundamentally, I think the big win is from a service-oriented model.
Okay, I think we are already over time. Let's thank the panelists once again.
Thank you.